morning.
Well, I guess that brings us to your arrival here at DuPont. I think your title was just research chemist. Is that?
You're a member of the research staff. All of the departments at DuPont had titles, and this has been an ongoing battle for all the years that I've been here. And with one exception, one of the other departments didn't use titles. And our view was that there was a great deal of prestige of just being the member of the research staff of a really good department. Other departments used a whole, senior, junior assistant, and all these things like this, all these sort of titles. And this was to show promotion in some people like this. Although I found that the top fellows in DuPont, when they came here and lost the fellow title, which was the big came to me 6 months later and said they couldn't care less. The freedom to do good science was much more important to them. So, we never had any titles. And in those days, we had a very skimpy infrastructure. We had members of the research staff, research supervisors, associate directors, who were sort of like a research manager. He had two or three supervisors under him, and then a assistant director of research and a director of research. We dropped having assistants not fairly early on, so pretty soon we just had a director of research, which was pretty high in DuPont levels, level-wise, was very way up there, and associate director, supervisors, and chemists. So it was really only four levels.
If I may ask, just out of curiosity, what was your first salary?
When I signed up, I think my first salary was $550 a month. And before I came to work, that's what was agreed on. And before I came to work, I got a letter saying I had a salary increase to $600. And this wasn't me, this was just the system at work. And those later, the latter 50s and the early 60s were that period where things were really changing rapidly. But particularly the 50s, we went through 2 and 3 salary increases a year sometimes. They were small, the point was we were rushing ahead, trying to reflect the growth in American economy and the competition for hiring and all of these things. But I can remember some years we would have things like 2 and 3 increases in a year, which is a great period to live through. I enjoyed that.
You mentioned that Cairns was the one responsible for your being here. Had you considered any other place?
I only interviewed one other place, and that was Roman Haas, because at the time there was a pretty good guy running research there and a few good things going on there. And I did interview them, but they didn't make me an offer. And I did interview, and I interviewed DuPont, and they did make me an offer, and I took it.
You said that Karen sort of had you come down here a year before you
That's
finished.
Right.
Assuming you came back for another interview.
I came back for a regular interview.
Who did you talk to, and what was it like?
On my first trip down here, I just visited Central Research in a very informal way, and I talked to some of the there was Dave England, who did so much in fluorine chemistry. I remember talking to Dave. Of course, Rudy Carboni had just come before me, and so I talked, of course, to Rudy and to several of the Ed Jenner, who was mechanistically inclined guy and very bright. Several of the staff here who were doing things that they could talk about. At that time, there were not There were a relatively small number of people who were known outside of the department, or known outside of the industry. The great days of publishing and getting involved with chemistry on a wider scope with university people and meetings and all like that occurred after I came here. And so a lot of the people that were here when I interviewed were not so well known outside. A few of them were, like England and what have you, but I guess I was very impressed with the esprit of the place and the kinds of things that they were doing. I mean, they were doing honest-to-goodness work that was not so far removed from academic work, and it sounded pretty pretty exciting. The second time I came here was a regular DuPont interview, whereas I spent one day with CRD, one day with the Explosives Department, one day with OrCam. I think it was three departments that I saw, and they all made me an offer, but I, of course, ended up taking this one. I met Herm Schroeder, who became the director of research in elastomers, and he was a supervisor at OrCam at the time. That was before elastomers department existed. And I was very impressed with him. We talked about it in later years. He was one of the people I really, really remembered. There were a lot of people at Explosives, too, that I made a very good impression on me. And I was not so much interested in an industrial career. I was interested in a chemistry career. Mm-hmm. And this is why I came to CRD, because it literally promised, from its own history, it promised that kind of career. And I never thought, really, of... And I, you know, it's easy to say these things, but it's very true. I never thought about a management career. Those sort of things never interested me in the least. And whether you believe it or not, I can tell you that virtually every promotion I've had has been had a fair element of surprise in it, because I didn't covet these things. My first response to any promotion has been almost a sinking feeling, because I didn't want the responsibility. I really didn't want the extra responsibility compared to the things that I was doing.
What was your?
We were told, by the way, in terms of salary. One of the top recruiters at DuPont, who was a PhD chemist himself, was Jack Renard, that many people that have came to DuPont in that period, many, many hundreds, I'm sure, knew or involved with him. I remember he told me that we could anticipate, by the time we retired in the normal course of events, if I stayed a scientist and went up and did well, didn't do anything special in terms of promotions to management or anything, that you could expect to double your salary by the time you retired. Mm. That's what was happening in America at the time. And I think by 1959 I doubled my salary.
Right. What was your first assignment? I'm not sure that's the right word, but when you first arrived, what were you asked to do?
Well, we were divided up into research groups that were more or less discipline-oriented. That is, this group would be mostly organic chemists, this one inorganic chemists, this one biochemist, or this one physicist, and what have you. In those days, we used to have, all of the groups used to have brainstorming sort of meetings where they would try to come up with interesting problems. These would get talked about, and then someone who had brought it, person that brought it up, would be given the job of casting this into one or two paragraphs in a formal form as a type of research proposal. And these were kept in a in a big bound book that all of us could look at. And very often the exploratory things were chosen out of that. When I first came here, I worked on a problem that Ted wanted worked on, and that was, I can't reproduce the rationality of it, but the idea was to make perfluoropolyacetylenes. That is, the simplest example would be a triple bond CF2 as a repeating unit. And there were some calculations suggesting some interesting or unusual properties of this. I don't think anyone has ever made a polymer exactly like that, and I don't think I'd be interested in doing it now. But there, it was somebody's wanted that looked at, and as a new guy on the block, I was assigned that. My first boss was Don Coughlin. Coughlin was the first guy to really spin nylon, and Julian Hill will shoot me if he hears me say that, but the fact is that that's probably true. Don was rewarded handsomely by the company, but died thinking that he had been denied the role of honor that he should have had. I think most of us felt that was right. He was the first guy that used a syringe and actually demonstrated the spinneret principle. He was a very, very fine classical organic chemist, one of the sweetest, nicest people I've ever known in my life. Outside of here, inside he was a martinet that we all hated. No one ever worked for Don that loved him. It was one of the more unusual things that I've encountered among lots of people is his ability to raise your hackles when you work for him. But that same evening he might have you to his house as for dinner, and you just could not find a warmer, nicer person. And he really was a warm, nice person, but he just did not know how to handle people under a work setting is what it boiled down to. But he was very interested in this perfluoropolyacetylene, and I worked on that. But then I started to branch out. I got disinterested in that and was working on other things. And for instance, I made the first ketals of a perfluoroketone, and these are really extraordinary materials. You can't hydrolyze them with concentrated hydrochloric acid or with metals, or they are really. And actually, later on, there are products now that involve that linkage, that kind of ketal linkage with a fluoroketone.
So I have paper number 10 on your list, I think, is the first one that was in that series. With Wiley.
Doug Wiley, yeah.
The idea of publishing
something,
was there much of a problem with that? DuPont led in the number of publications.
Well, again, the man that pushed this prior to my coming and certainly brought it to a head after I was here was Ted Cairns again. Ted was very adamant about this. The gripes came primarily from the industrial departments. And even as late as the 70s and 80s, there were high people in industrial departments who believed that nothing should be, you're giving succor to the enemy if you publish anything. And that the only time you published is when this was in concert to strengthen, with some patent purpose, that you were going to strengthen the value of the patent or what have you. But we finally worked out a scheme that we had the departments review in a fairly short order, whether they, and I think the secret there was to deluge them with so many applications for publication that they had to succumb. But we did eventually come down to a point where things that were of just scientific value, but there was no clear company interest could go through pretty quickly. And if there wasn't, there were some clear rules about what to do next and to get this to the point where we could publish it. And occasionally you might have to really give up for a while. But when it was working its best, the bulk of the things out of here were being published, and only the truly industrially significant things were being held up. But there are many people in DuPont who wanted to hold up the whole damn works. Mm.
I was going to ask how you responded to, when you started here, to what, let me call it, the industrial mentality. You know, going to meetings, mm-hmm. talking to other people, other places, yeah. and so on. Did you have to be aware of, you know, let's say a good scientific discussion as opposed to,
right.
I can't say this because
yeah,
it might
right.
affect the company?
Yeah, I think that, again, if you're a reasonably serious scientist, that's mainly manifested in the early years. As soon as you've been around for a few years, you've got enough things that you can talk about that aren't going to get you into... Most people that work in a setting like a corporate laboratory here will retire with a huge number of unpublished things. It's a tragedy. I mean, I've got drawers full of stuff that, with a little bit of, with just writing, some with a little bit of cleaning up here or there, would make an interesting paper. But as I say, once you're here for 5 or 6 years, I think you're, and by that time you're probably, when you're at ACS meetings or maybe going to give a talk at a school or something, you do have usually enough things to talk about. I think you're right, though. There's an awkwardness in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you tired of Karen's polyacetylene early.
Right.
And how did you move into the fluoroketone area?
Well, I just did it, and in those days, you know, it was closer to following, let me start that again. We were always encouraged to spend 10% of our time here in what we wanted to do. And there was a point where I was spending much more than 10%, because I just didn't see anything entrancing about perfluoropolyacetylenes. And that was solved. Kaufman wasn't very happy with me for doing this until Dave McQueen, who was the director of research, who just stopped in the lab one day, as he was wont to do with young scientists and relatively new people, and he asked me what I was doing, and so I told him and showed him what I was doing with these fluoroketone ketals, and he said, "Well, that's not your program, is it?" And I said, "No." And I said, "It'll probably get me in some trouble." And he said, "For God's sake, don't worry about any of that. You work on whatever you want to work on. Work." He's looked great to me, and he said something like this and like that. So that put the end to perfluoro polyacetylenes. I never went back to fooling them again.
You also very early on, I'm just looking, you joined here in 54, you had some first papers out of DuPont, came in 58, I think. That was with Smith on the cyclopropane synthesis, which was really, again, a pretty unique kind of paper. How did you...
Just exploratory on the side, and as I said, reading the old literature and reading Emshwiller. If you remember, at that time, Dering and others were doing, so Hines were doing so much in methyl, in carbene chemistry and what have you. It was a very exciting thing to think about. And I thought that there was a remote chance that this intermediate might, that the intermediate in Emshwiller's work might be a low-energy methylene, just like the low-energy dichlorocarbenes were, since it was not formed from a diazo compound or irradiation or whatever. And of course, that didn't turn out to be turn out to be so, but it turned out to even be more exciting because it was a long-lived carbonoid which reacted with even unactivated double bonds. So I found this, and as a matter of fact, I ran the reaction with, the first time I ever ran it was with cyclohexene, and this is usually just a faintly exothermic reaction if it works well. So after running it, I think several hours, I had no idea whether anything had happened, but I distilled the, filtered off the solids and distilled the product, and sure enough, the boiling point went, after just a little bit of cyclohexene, went up to where norcarine was supposed to boil, but there's very little norcarine, and Dering had all of that up at Hickerell Foundation, and so Doug Wiley called up Larry Knox, who was this black chemist who ran the Hickerell Foundation for Dering, and Larry read him the infrared bands out of the their infrared spectrum of norcarine, and sure enough, that's what it was. And see, I was sitting there with a bottle of norcarine, probably more than it ever existed in the world. So that was pretty exciting. So I then just tried to look, it's like a pig at a trough. There's everything to try, these double bonds to try. And so I did that for a while, and it was from the patent standpoint, trying to get the scope of the reaction and that sort of thing. And did a few experiments to look at the mechanism, and then this fellow Ron Smith came along. Ron was a Caltech undergraduate in MIT graduate school. And his first problem was he was assigned to work with me on this too. And so we worked, again, mainly synthetically, looking at synthetic questions. It was later, in the early 60s, that I worked on the mechanism of this with Doc Blanchard, another MIT guy, and Doc was a postdoc of mine for 4 years here. We had an arrangement in those days, it was such a glorious period, where a guy would be hired by DuPont, and if he was willing, and someone like myself as a research supervisor willing, he could put himself under me as a postdoctoral student, internal postdoctoral student, and still have the same salary and get the same wages and what have you. And Doc stayed as a postdoc of mine for almost 4 years, and we did a lot of mechanistic work on that. I think the first GC kinetics Doc had built a really nice system for doing that. Then he came up on his own, which I had nothing to do with, the first real synthesis of a bicyclobutane, and where again we sent oh my golly, my son got a degree at Yale, Ken Weiberg. We sent Ken a bottle. This was a methyl and a cyano at the bridgeheads, but Doc did very well on his own. He became a supervisor. He went from a postdoc to a supervisor here. After a year or so, he took off like a bird, went to our old film department, and shot up to become vice chairman of DuPont. And so it was very nice all along the way to be able to boast of my hiring skills and my training skills. So Doc and I remained close friends over the years, and those were grand days.
One of the things that I wanted to also ask you about was, you were also at a time when instrumentation was changing rapidly.
Yeah.
Even if you look at some of your early, those first papers, it's melting points,
right,
IR,
right,
maybe a UV.
Right.
And I think it was the cyclopropane paper where,
right,
maybe the first time you used GC is a...
Right.
And then you used NMR with the fluoroketones. And was Roberts here at that time? Was he was consulting?
Jack Jack was a consultant, not at CRD, but he was a consultant at the old ORCAP department.
Okay.
Before I came to DuPont, and when the first ferrocenes were scraped out of a stack over there, Jack brought them back and was measuring, doing Dipole moment measurements on these chlorinated ferrocenes. And he wouldn't tell any of us what it was. He had us doing these measurements for him on the side at MIT, but he couldn't tell us what they suspected they were or what they knew they were. I think his consulting goes back to 52 or 51 or something like that. It's probably right, maybe even 50. I think he's been consulting at least 40 years. I think his 40th one was 91 or something like that, 40th anniversary.
Approaching Carl Marmol's record.
Yeah, yes, 50 years. Yeah, incredible. But that's right. And one of the another MIT guy here, Bill Phillips, was a spectroscopist, and Bill got into NMR very early, and Varian and DuPont got together, and Varian's first machine was here at the experimental station. So we had a real leg up on the... And we were fortunate in having Bill Phillips, who ultimately switched fields and became a molecular biologist and went on to an incredible career of doing all sorts of things. And has happened to be my closest, over all the years, my closest personal friend. Bill and I have been close personal friends for many years. But he was the guy that did so much for getting NMR used in chemistry as an analytical tool. And if you'll notice that Jack Roberts' dedication of his first little book on NMR is to Bill. He dedicates it to Bill Phillips for teaching him all this. So Phillips was really on his own, and like rotating methyl groups and things. These were just totally unknown that you could do these things. Mm-hmm. And so Bill did a lot of. He wasn't the only one, but he was one of the major people. And he had all of these marvelous things, these fluorinated compounds here, and all sorts of things to be able to work with at DuPont. So, and plus a DuPont support and a machine. So. We got into NMR fairly promptly.